The jobless rate gets better in big cities.
Does this mean the economy's turning a corner?
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org on this Wednesday, December 7th.
Coming up, the incredible shrinking middle class.
The European Union might not be so united when it comes to saving the Eurozone.
And could reality TV be coming to the U.S. Supreme Court?
All that coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
President Obama this week is talking a lot about the middle class, trying to pressure Congress to extend the payroll tax cut and urging economic fairness for people who have suffered during the Great Recession, including millions of Americans who are out of work. But new jobless data suggests things may be turning around. The unemployment rate in three quarters, 75% of big metro areas across the country, fell in November. And some of the biggest job gainers, cities of the Midwest and the Rust Belt. George Zeller is an economic research analyst who joins us now from Cleveland. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Steve.
So, really, the Rust Belt? I mean, what's going on there? I thought the Rust Belt was like bleeding jobs.
Yes, for a very long time, we've had a horrible economic situation out here in Ohio. The national recession has just clobbered the world, but recently we've seen a slow recovery here in Ohio, I'm very glad to say, and the source of the recovery is manufacturing growth.
What kind of things are people making now?
We've had a huge expansion at the General Motors Lordstown Assembly Plant, where they manufactured screws. In addition, Youngstown, where the steel industry was decimated decades ago, has a huge steel mill under construction right now. And the market for all this, of course, is auto sales, which have been robust.
You think, George, this is a sign that we're actually recovering, or do you think something else is going on here?
Oh, it is a genuine recovery here in Ohio, especially the manufacturing portion, which ripples into the rest of the economy. But we still have economic problems that are severe. But I'm very glad to say that we have a national model in Youngstown, of all places, which is growing more robustly than any place in Ohio.
George Zeller, economic research analyst from Cleveland. George, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
So is the middle class really shrinking? For that, we turn to Marketplace's Gregory Warner, who joins us this morning with the latest. Good morning, Gregory.
Good morning.
So, Gregory, how unequal are we right now?
Well, the middle class is shrinking. The president quoted from last month's report by the CBO that the income for the top 1% is up 250%. There's a study, I think, out of Stanford University that brings these numbers home in a different way. So if you figure 1970, most of us, two out of three Americans, lived in middle income neighborhoods. In 2007, less than half do. So when they say the American middle class is shrinking, it's not just take-home pay. I mean, it's literally who your neighbors are. It's where your schools are. It's your community.
Turning then to the wealthiest community in the country, which is Washington, D.C., what's the latest political deadlock?
Well, payroll tax cuts. President Obama's been pushing to extend these tax breaks to next year, and this would increase your take-home pay by about 2% or 3% extra on your paycheck. The debate, of course, is how to pay for it. Democrats want to pay for this with a temporary tax on millionaires. Republicans are against that, and that's up for a vote tomorrow, which is predicted to fail, but who knows? Things are shifting.
Our own Gregory Warner in Philadelphia. Thank you, Gregory.
Thanks a lot.
Over to Europe now, and just ahead of a big EU summit on Friday, our nation's Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says he feels good about progress being made. He's in Europe now, and they're trying, of course, to tackle the huge debt crisis there and to save the euro currency. The central part of that plan so far would change European Union treaties, and any one of EU member countries could derail the whole plan. Enter Slovakia, which almost thwarted the latest Greek bailout. Vladimir Bilčík is with the Slovak Foreign Policy Association. He's with us now from Bratislava. Hi, Mr. Bilčík.
Hello.
I know the last time Slovakia had to vote, it was over whether to expand Greece's bailout package. You know, that was a contentious vote. And now we're talking about changing treaties and amending them. How would that play out in Slovakia, do you think?
I think it actually is likely to play out a lot smoother than in the case of our vote on the extension of the bailout fund. Slovakia is understanding we are dealing with existential questions here now, and politicians have been saying today and yesterday that most of them, with the exception of two political parties in parliament, are willing to pass some major changes to the EU treaties because they understand this is really about not just the future of Slovakia, but the future of the Eurozone and the EU itself.
Now, I know Slovakia is just one country, though. I mean, any one country in the EU could derail this. I mean, do you think that if something like that happens, that's it for the Eurozone?
Ideally, it would be great if all 27 countries at the upcoming summit agreed that we would extend the treaties and actually go down further fiscal integration. We need a quick solution. The EU has been extremely sluggish at coming up with a solution, and I'm afraid we are facing a real split within the EU, and the deeper integration will apply only to a group of countries.
Vladimir Bilček from the Slovak Foreign Policy Association. Mr. Bilček, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Getting the green light from all of the European Union member states might be really, really tough. British Prime Minister David Cameron has expressed some reservations. The BBC's Matthew Davis has more from London.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy seem to be very keen to rewrite some of Europe's treaties, bringing in new rules for fiscal discipline, which they hope will finally end the region's economic woes. But Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron says he won't sign any new treaties that threaten British interests, including the profitability of London as a major financial centre.
When I go to Brussels, I will be there to defend and promote British interests. We want the single currency crisis solved, but we will protect and defend British interests at the same time.
If Mr. Cameron feels unable to accept a new European Union treaty, the 17 countries who actually use the euro currency may have to come up with yet another plan among themselves. In London, I'm the BBC's Matthew Davis for Marketplace.
Of course, Stacey, the known causes of that crisis include excessive debt and uncontrolled public spending, right? Some of the roots of those economic woes can be traced through history, all the way back to Germany's infamous and murderous leader, Adolf Hitler. Marketplace's, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that.
If you're looking for someone to blame for the Eurozone debt crisis, you could start with this man. It was after the death and destruction caused by Hitler and his regime in the 1940s that Europe set off down the path that led to the common currency. Economist Andrew Hilton.
We wouldn't have had the euro had it not been for the experience of the Second World War and the determination of a generation of European leaders immediately after the war to make sure it didn't happen again.
For 40 years after the war, West Germany forged an ever closer political and economic union with its neighbours, eliminating trade barriers, harmonising regulations. Largely to atone for the horrors that Hitler had unleashed, the Germans submerged themselves in Europe. But then in 1989 came a thrilling but destabilising event.
One man's just come through, raised his arms in the air and declared, "I've made it."
The fall of the Berlin Wall posed a dilemma, the prospect of West Germany reuniting with its eastern territory. Jan Randolph is with IHS Global Insight.
That would not only bulk up Germany economically, it would also make Germany a political power again, a more assertive, self-interested political power.
And that rang alarm bells most loudly in France, which had been a major target for Hitler's aggression. Charles Grant of the Centre for European Reform says the French insisted the Germans bind themselves even more tightly to their European partners.
The French said, sure, you can be reunified, but let's make quite certain you're going to agree to give up the Deutschmark and take part in a common currency, aren't you? And the Germans, with some reluctance, said yes.
Hitler's baleful effect can be seen everywhere in this story. Because of his legacy, it could be argued, the Germans have dithered during the current crisis, reluctant to play a dominant, decisive role. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
The banking giant Citigroup announced it's going to lay off 4,500 workers. Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and Wells Fargo have also announced layoffs in recent months. Here to talk about this with us is Josh Brown, vice president at Fusion Analytics in New York. He joins us as he does every Wednesday. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning. How's it going?
It's going well. Josh, why do we keep seeing these job cuts from banks?
I just think the banks are still too big. The business of banking traditionally is pretty boring, doesn't require quite the levels of staff that they took on in the last decade. So I think the layoffs from companies like Citi, Bank of America, are going to be an ongoing feature, unfortunately.
Now, Josh, to change subjects a bit, the big market mover this morning is the situation in Europe, of course. What are the markets reacting to right now?
You know, there are a lot of big expectations built in to this massive Euro summit that's set to take place at the end of this week. And so far, it appears they did not like the headlines of some of the things that are being discussed. So if you look at, for example, the stock market, the bond market in Germany and Italy, they were trading decently, and then all of a sudden, that old headline risk came back out. Some comments were made about there's not going to be any kind of huge solution or silver bullet. And so what that ends up doing is it takes the speculators out of the market, and there really aren't any other buyers to fill their shoes. So that's what we're seeing this morning.
So you're expecting to see kind of a dragged out solution?
Yeah, I mean, this is not going to be a quickie divorce. If, in fact, the Europe ends up breaking up, it'll probably be in a couple of years. There are still so many solutions and levers to pull and switches to flip on and off. There are a lot more things that will be attempted before they just give up on this project. So I think the markets are coming to grips with that. I think expectations are nothing special, either for a huge solution or a huge breakup. And that's kind of where we are right now.
Josh Brown with Fusion Analytics in New York. Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Josh, Stacey, today's Washington Post reports GOP presidential hopeful Newt Gingrich's campaign is under a mountain of debt, having spent a lot of early money on things such as luxury jets, among other things. Catching up may be hard, though, because even though Gingrich's poll numbers are surging, campaign contributions aren't necessarily, and up to now, it hasn't really mattered. From Washington, here's Marketplace's John Dimsdale.
At the end of September, the Gingrich campaign was $1 million in debt. Still, Gingrich has been a national politician for two decades.
In a strange way, he doesn't need quite as much money as those who have been busy raising it and spending it for months now.
Presidential historian Stephen Hess at Brookings says money isn't as important for someone with name recognition like Gingrich.
Strange things are happening, including the fact that candidates got this far by simply participating in debate after debate, which costs them virtually nothing.
But with Iowa voting just a month away, Gingrich's late start could become a liability. Political scientist Jack Pitney is at Claremont McKenna College.
The question is whether Gingrich can assemble a combination of professionals and volunteers that can deliver results on caucus night.
Pitney expects Gingrich donations to start rolling in, but he says Wall Street favors Mitt Romney, so a lot of the cash will come from lobbyists on Washington's K Street, Gingrich's home since he resigned as Speaker of the House. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So, Steve, are you a big TV watcher?
No, not really. But I'm sure
there
are. Yeah, I'm a political junkie, so I watch a lot of C-SPAN. Absolutely.
Well, I have very good news for you.
Yeah.
Supreme Court TV could be coming to a television near you. Congress is reportedly trying to pass a bill that would require Supreme Court proceedings to be televised. It's part of an effort to make the high court more transparent. So, as you can imagine, some justices have spoken out against the idea. But, you know, Steve, I kind of think this could be a hit. Just imagine the Honorable Simon Cowell has a certain ring to it.
Not in a billion years. There are only so many words I can drag out of my vocabulary to say how awful that was.
Now that is good TV. And of course, if you have some feedback for us, we'd love to hear it. Send it to letters@marketplace.org.
The Food and Drug Administration could decide today whether to remove age restrictions from the morning after pill. Now, right now, the drug known as Plan B is locked up behind pharmacy counters, and whoever wants to buy it has to be at least 17. But if the FDA lifts the age ban, those pills will find their way to drugstore aisles, which has been a boon for other drugs that have made similar jumps. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
Sales of the Plan B pill have been on the rise since the drug received its age-restricted over-the-counter status 5 years ago, and future sales could be astronomical if it comes out from behind the counter altogether. So says Professor Ken Caton at the Tufts University School of Medicine. He says drug makers have learned they can milk more profits from their popular brand names by removing the requirement for a prescription.
In fact, in many cases, the sales of the over-the-counter product exceeded the sales of the patented product, in other words, when it was still prescription only.
Consider the first year that blockbuster allergy treatment Claritin was approved for non-prescription use. Sharing Plow saw a 90% jump in sales of its over-the-counter drugs. Laura Maecha follows the healthcare industry for Klein Market Research. She says there's another benefit. Non-prescription drugs tend to be cheaper, although insurance companies end up saving the most.
Once it goes OTC, they no longer have to cover it.
So consumers end up paying for the convenience. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, the Senate will vote in the confirmation hearing of Richard Cordray as head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Cordray is the former Ohio Attorney General. He was picked over Elizabeth Warren to head the CFPB, partially because he was thought to be more politically neutral. But now Republicans say they will block Cordray's nomination anyway. David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the LA Times. He joins me now. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So, David, what's the problem? Why are Senate Republicans threatening to block Cordray's nomination?
Well, they say that they feel that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau needs more accountability and more transparency, so they want to see some structural changes to it. That's their story. What consumer advocates are saying is these guys basically want to water down the agency and make it friendlier to businesses. And the key change that they want to make is to do away with the director altogether and instead bring in a five-person commission that advocates say would be more easily influenced by industry. It would have Republicans, it would have Democrats, and as we've seen with the Federal Communications Commission, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, when you've got a mixture of ideologies on the commission, business has a few more ways of getting their point across.
What does this mean for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is, for those who don't remember, the centerpiece for the 2010 Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act?
Well, what it means is not all of the things that the agency can do are being done right now. And it is doing many of its things. It's overseeing credit cards. It's overseeing mortgages. It's doing that kind of thing. But some of the new things that the agency is appointed to look after, such as payday loans, it cannot do until it has a director in place. And moreover, it's leaderless at the moment. It just simply does not have someone running the show. Elizabeth Warren built it up from scratch, and now she's out of the picture. And so until we bring in Richard Cordray or whoever to run this thing, well, basically it's not going to get any momentum until a new leadership is in place.
And if you don't mind getting your crystal ball out now, David, what do you think is going to happen with this vote?
So what we can expect going forward is probably a recess appointment, likely in January. And the president will appoint Cordray then. And then there'll be a whole new fight as the Republicans scream about the fact that the president has circumvented due process. And the president has said these guys are trying to block consumer protection. And once again, the game will continue.
David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the LA Times. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we got word early today about the latest inductees to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. You know who made the list, Stacey?
No.
The Beastie Boys?
Huh? Oh,
Guns
okay.
N' Roses? Guns N' Sweet Child of Mine, right?
Right,
and,
right.
And these guys.
The ceremony is not until April, but the announcement itself can boost record sales as much as 40% to 60% in a week, according to market watchers. In today's Midday Extra, we ask, what does joining the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame do for an artist? Joel Parisman is president and CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation. He joins us. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you two? Nice to talk to you.
Hey, Joel. Yeah, thanks for being here.
Well, it's an exciting day for us.
And have you been making the calls this morning?
Yeah, actually, right when you rang me before, I was just on with Donovan, who was in Monaco or someplace.
What was Donovan doing when you talked to him? Did he like just get out of the shower or something?
You know, I don't know. He was wherever he is. He's in Europe, so he's 6 hours ahead of us. So hopefully, he's showered by this point.
I promise we'll get to the economic angle in just a second, Joel, but I want to know the biggest name, the top guy that you, or gal, as it were, that you may have spoken to on the phone to tell them that they're being inducted.
Well, I've talked to Tom Waits.
Really?
Wow, that's pretty fantastic, which is great.
You know, there's been a few other artists here and there. I'm just trying to remember, offhand. But, it's just, it's always a good moment, even when you talk to the people that work with them. And you really see it when they get to the ceremony. The ceremony, because it's something that's unlike a lot of the other award ceremonies, this is something that happens once. It's not something that they can get nominated for and win every year. It's almost like, in a way, a lifetime achievement award, in a sense. So especially as they get to the ceremony, and you see when they get there, when we're doing rehearsals, and they're seeing the other artists that are involved, and they get up on stage, you get these really wonderful, heartfelt moments that just, don't happen again.
Now, how do you choose the artists? Do the fans have a say? Or?
Well, at this point, they don't. There's a process. There's a nominating committee of people that are, knowledgeable about the history of music. There's musicians on it. There's writers, there's critics, there's people from the business, but they're all kind of vetted to make sure that they really have a kind of like a deep understanding of rock and roll. And everyone might have different kind of likes. Someone might be more steeped in early 60s. Someone might be more, on hard rock. Someone might be more on hip hop. But everyone kind of gets together in a room and puts together, each person puts up their three choices of who they feel should be inducted and why. So it becomes a pretty democratic process, and it's also a process that, you try to keep kind of outside influences from lobbying, because, you have smart people putting forth their opinions, and they're discussed to get the list of nominees, which this year there are 15, and then it goes out to a larger group of about 600 voters made up of past inductees and people in the business and knowledgeable about music.
It sounds like Price Waterhouse or something like that, like the winner of the Miss America contest.
Well, there's no sashes or crowns involved.
It depends on the band.
True.
Guns N' Roses had some crazy days.
Madonna? Okay. So why a sales bump, though, Joel? Because I know that these are a lot of established artists who have sold a lot of records anyway. So why would they get a sales bump just by being inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Kind of puts a spot, a well-deserved spotlight on these artists at times when maybe it's either between albums, it's in a different part in their career, it's on certain times, in their touring cycle. It just puts a really high-profile kind of stamp of approval on these artists that kind of goes to the public and say, gee, this act just got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes.
That's interesting. I remember them or I know them. Let me go check them out and see what's happening. Why did they get inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And they kind of start listening, and they start checking out their music and buying their music. So it just creates a little bit of a role for people. And a big-name artist like a Bruce Springsteen or something, is this going to have a huge effect on his career or album sales? Probably not, if you're using an example. But on other artists that we've spoken to that, they've been working, it might have been big artists at one time that aren't on this level that they were, I think it just gives them another little hit. An act like The Ventures or Alice Cooper or others, it just kind of all of a sudden it makes people focus on them and realize why they are great and why they deserve to be in the Hall of Fame.
Cool.
Joel Parisman is president and CEO of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Foundation. Thank you, Joel, for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joel.
All right. Thank you, guys.
And finally, this morning, Stacey, Joel, stupidity and bad luck often make for a valuable lesson in life. You got to admit, last Saturday, a 22-year-old man from Maryland tried to shoplift more than $600 worth of video games from a local Walmart.
In fairness, that's probably like two video games.
I think there were more than two dozen that he tried down his pants, which I thought was funny. Who's not going to notice 26 video games down your pants and in your sweatshirt? Anyway, store monitors watched the guy shove all these games in his clothing. But when he went to leave, a throng of police officers tackled and arrested him in the parking lot. But the store didn't have to call the police. There was a community.
They were just at Walmart?
Yeah, there was a community program going on at the store that day called Shop with a Cop.
No! Yes. Worst day to shoplift ever.
Ever, ever. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.